And you're listening to Thinking Out Loud on WUML Lowell, and we're here with John McDougall from the Regional Economic and Social Development Department here at UMass Lowell. We use a lot of acronyms here. It's almost like the old Soviet Union. So this is called RESD by those who are in the know. And he's also working with an organization called the Peace and Conflict Studies Institute here at UMass Lowell. Good morning.
Good morning.
I guess we'd like to just talk a little about what you have been doing lately and what you have planned for this summer here in the RESD department.
Oh, thank you. One thing that I've been working on with some colleagues for the past 12 months or so is a spin-off of the Peace and Conflict Studies Institute, and we now have as a program inside of the RESD, RESD master's degree, sort of inside. We have a graduate level certificate called Peace and Conflict Resolution Studies, just got started, and we worked on that because we felt that it was important, especially obviously in the context since 9/11, it was important for people to understand not only the dynamics of all the violence at home and abroad, but for also people to get some kind of skills in dealing with conflicts in a more constructive way. So we have not only peace and the study of peace and conflict, but also conflict resolution as part of what we're doing with this program.
And conflict resolution, that is teaching people skills they can use when they get into local situations where there's conflict.
Absolutely.
Bring people together.
Right. Although these skills could also be of use on the international stage. So, for example, if somebody wanted to work with an international human rights organization, that would be fine. And I might mention that when we set this certificate up, we arranged with the administration that the certificate will consist of actually five courses. And usually a graduate certificate is four, but this time it's five. The reason for that is that there are four courses on academic matters, but then there is one course that everybody has to take, which we called a field experience course, which is a skill-building course, as you mentioned, Jim. And we're really delighted that people will have that opportunity to pick up some real skills and get exposed to the whole field of dealing with conflicts constructively.
And for a field experience course, what type of thing might people be involved in?
Well, these are early days. We're not sure. But what we're thinking of is, as I mentioned, human rights is one kind of area of work. Mediation is another. And by the way, we're in touch with a really good program at UMass Boston that has a very extensive program in mediation. They have a whole dispute resolution program. I think it's disres.umb.edu is the website people might like to check. So there are various things like that. People may also want to become quite active in, say, peace organizations involved in organizing. In labor, for example, I heard you had some segments on that just now, and that certainly would be a possibility. We're still working out exactly how that would actually play itself out.
Yeah, from my point of view, much of labor organizing does involve making conflicts that are actually there already visible in the world and that kind of thing, and taking a polarized stance. Part of it may have to do with getting into negotiation sessions and resolving the differences once those differences have been made manifest. But I guess the peacemaking skills that you would be more involved in the negotiating side than in the, say, demand-making, striking, organizing workers?
Probably, right. I mean, obviously there's a whole discussion about when you make demands in order to create a level playing field. I mean, this was something that Martin Luther King was very concerned with. And you get militant to bring issues out into the open. In fact, you and I were discussing a little bit before the show, there is a concept we use in peace studies called structural violence. We hear a lot about what we call overt violence, wars, rapes, and so on. But structural violence is exemplified in a segment I heard just before I went on the air from Haiti, where there's not just the violence being used against strikers, but they're the ongoing conditions, the really grim, of workers who back home have no running water, no electricity, all kinds of horrendous problems like that. And, of course, on the job, as we know, there are a lot of workplaces that are extremely unsafe. So I think there will be an issue that will come up about how to bring to the fore some underlying kind of violence that's already there. but always, of course, to do it in a nonviolent, constructive, respectful kind of way, regardless of who your adversaries are and regardless of what you might personally think of your adversaries.
Yeah, so calling names doesn't necessarily help in these kinds of situations, but in having some skills in showing what the nature of the problem is and correcting the underlying problems.
Right. Right. In fact, in our certificate, we have two substantive courses that people have to take. One is a course called conflict resolution, which gets at some of these things, these issues. The second course is a somewhat more academic course called analyzing peace, violence, and war, where we try to look at the concepts. But in all cases, like you say, the crucial thing is to really look for another way of looking at how these issues are portrayed, because in so much of our culture we have what my colleague at Brandeis Gordy Fellman calls an adversarial kind of culture instead of what he calls instead a mutualistic one, where we are partners together. Even though we may disagree, at least let's try to work together and deal with the issue that's out there, say the lack of decent clean energy for our society. Well, let's see if we can have the different countries work on that rather than, you know, fight over the limited amount of oil that's there in Iraq, Saudi Arabia, and so on.
And see if there's a way out of the, you know, seemingly intractable conflicts that come out of oil.
Right.
My wife has just been reading a book called The Prize, which goes into the history of the oil industry and how it's affected world politics.
Right.
And it seems like it is really a no-win game when you for most of the people in the world.
Right.
If you concentrate on that one solution to the problem, but if you've concentrated on some of the other solutions, and you know, wind, hydrogen, solar power, small-scale hydroelectric power, things along those lines, then it would look much less grim.
Right. Absolutely. Right. And there's another book, actually, I brought along with me that kind of spins off from the book called The Prize. It's a book called Resource Wars by Michael Clare, K-L-A-R-E, who's out at Hampshire College. A really excellent account of how a lot of the wars we see in the world now are driven, obviously, by oil, but perhaps less conspicuously by water. I believe it was Mark Twain who said that whiskey is for drinking, but water is for fighting. So there is a lot of conflicts that are clearly resource-driven. And as I've indicated, what we try to do with this new program and with a number of the other programs I've done over the years at Peace and Conflict Studies Institute is to expose students to what actually is going on that's more constructive, both at home and abroad, because it seems to me that apart from a wonderful exception, this station and this show, you know, our mainstream media just gives us very little that we can draw on to really derive help, hope and feel optimistic about the way the world is going.
There are a lot of these little exceptions here and there around the country. It's not. It's a matter of where the money is, I guess. Money is, seems to determine how much of a certain kind of media we get. Money seems to determine what kind of fuel we get. So somehow, some of the skills we need to develop is ways of getting money placed in the right, you know, the money people to put their money in the right place. That's really difficult because many of the people who feel the needs most acutely are not rich.
Right.
And here in the United States, we need to, there are people like Co-op America doing very skillful work with wealthy people who have money to spare, getting them to put it into the projects that could really use that money.
Right, right.
So here's, and it's interesting, you've got a quote here on your brochure for the Peace and Conflict Studies Institute. Peace is the positive external condition in which people are free. People are not exploited, living so that they grow to their full potential. And this is from Petra Kelly, the German Green leader who is who died, I guess, maybe 10 years ago.
Right.
But a rather powerful statement. You don't have peace unless you have something very positive going on in your life.
Right. Right. Again, that's a concept that we'll introduce in the more theoretical course in our graduate certificate, which is, like you say, called positive peace, because often we talk about peace plans, say, between Israel and Palestine. And that is really what scholars have called negative peace, just the absence of overt violence. We certainly need that. But to break down racial stereotypes, for example, to provide real economic justice, to provide equal access to scarce resources, like water and oil. You know, that is a much more difficult, complex process, but I think we have to get started on it.
And just putting boundaries on the suffering that people have is not enough.
Right.
I somehow have to come up with a solution that actually benefits both parties or all parties concerned.
Right, right.
And
right.
The other quote you have here is from Pope John Paul VI. Pope Paul the VI. If you want peace, work for justice.
Right.
That gets into what you were saying earlier about structural violence. Structural violence is not what we normally think of as violence. It's not somebody coming and hitting you on the head or shooting you or dropping a bomb on you. It's the daily conditions of life, as you
right.
were talking about.
Exactly, right.
And so around the country there are responses to this structural violence that are going on.
Absolutely, right.
There is a mediation program that I'm familiar with in my part of New Hampshire that goes around to schools and mediates conflicts between students, teaches students the skills needed to then do peer mediation mm-hmm. and avoid violence in the schools. Everyone sees food banks and homeless shelters. All of these little institutions, they operate quietly and on surprisingly large scale and sometimes, but they're not something that's featured in our when we think about war and peace, violence and social violence.
Right.
We don't think about these institutions, but they're vital.
Right. Absolutely. And I might mention, actually, that with PACSI, the Peace and Conflict Studies Institute, for the past couple of years, we've developed a really close relationship with a woman who I think is a fabulous trainer in this whole field, a woman called Barbara Hilt, who used to be a state representative, and was also, an interesting, worn a hat as the president of Women's Action for New Directions, a major peace organization. Anyway, she has now founded a nonprofit mainly based in Amesbury, where she lives, and it's called Youth Empowerment Services, yes. And she has done quite a bit of training already with students at UMass Lowell and some other folks that we've connected with in the community. One student I worked with this past semester has worked in Draycott High School, conducted a couple of classes after getting trained by Barbara. And they have a website. It's, I think, youthempowerment.org. And I'm really delighted that we've been able to establish that relationship with somebody who's really one of the very best trainers here in Massachusetts, exactly the kind of thing you mentioned in New Hampshire.
So just look in any community and you'll see institutions that are set up to act quite differently from the dominant institutions of our culture, which are violent institutions.
Right.
And then other thing that you wanted to mention, I understand, is that there are alternative ways of thinking about the world.
Right.
If you want to mention some of those?
Sure. One of the alternative ways of thinking, I think, is to say that as much as possible, we look for what we call positive sum solutions, where it's not my getting more of the cake means you get less of the cake, but if you will, you get more of the pie and I get less. It's rather to make the whole pie bigger, if we possibly can. So finding win-win solutions is really important. Also, building trust, and it's a difficult thing, whether it's at the, say, within families, in communities, workplaces, but it clearly can be done. And I've seen families where, say, looking at that level, somebody is the child of parents who have fought like crazy, but this person has gone on to build a fabulous relationship with their children, with their spouses. And, this can be done. It takes some skill. It takes a lot of patience. So I think that's a part of it. And a final part, and all of this, by the way, is this book by Gordon Fellman, F-E-L-L-M-A-N, called Rambo and the Dalai Lama. I think a terrific book, and my students have loved it. And Gordy talks about empathy as another theme. You have to, as the Native Americans say, walk in the other person's moccasins. Again, not easy, but we can teach that, I think. And in my opinion, at least, universities are a really great place to do that.
So, there's empathy, and there's also, I guess there are different ways of looking at the world. You mentioned also the Dalai Lama as someone who teaches a different way of looking at the world.
Right.
And is there anything in particular that you want to...
Well, I was actually lucky enough, along with thousands of others, to see him and hear him when he came and talked at the Fleet Center last September. And one of the things that struck me about him as an individual, but I think in a way it applies to the general practice of peace. He was, in some ways, a very ordinary guy. I believe he refers himself as a simple monk, and it was like you were sitting in on his in his living room having a chat with somebody, a friend of his. And he, of course, does not want anybody to necessarily sign on to his kind of spirituality. If they want to work with him and become Tibetan Buddhist, fine. But he's very emphatic that if you are a Christian and that's really your faith, fine, stay with that. If you don't have any religious faith, that's fine. And it's interesting, I think a lot of spiritual leaders are now saying that it's much more important to, if you will, walk the talk, you know, to really practice the golden rule, do to others as you would have them do to you, to build up trust in these things I've mentioned, rather than to sign on to any particular creed. And he was, I think, emphatic about that. And I think that's one reason that he appears in the title of the book that Gordy wrote.
So that's, I see, that's the other thing. So as for Rambo's example, I guess we have enough of that on practically every medium that we can watch or hear.
Right.
Go ahead.
Yes, I was going to say, just wanted to switch gears a little bit, Jim, if that's all right, because something where I'd love to get some responses from people out there in your audience is I'm teaching a course this summer in the second session, which I mentioned to you earlier, and this is going in a somewhat different direction. Anyway, it's a course called Social Movements and Empowerment, and this is really trying to understand how social movements work, how they arise, then what makes them successful and help people build some skills in organizing in social movements. Again, the issue we discussed earlier of always approaching issues constructively comes up, but also the issue comes up of bringing things to the forefront that may have been hidden. Because in my opinion, and maybe some of our listeners agree or disagree, but in my view, enormous amount of the social progress that we've had in the past century has been attributable to social movements. I mean, just look at race relations. Obviously, the civil rights movement of the 50s and 60s has been absolutely crucial there. So in this course, where I'd love to get some more students, we will look at that, but we'll also give students an opportunity to actually do some project for some activist organization that they may already be involved in or they'd like to get involved. It would be a fairly small project. Last time I taught the course, I had a student work with a women's labor organization, and they were organizing a conference, and she did a really nice job of a lot of the nuts and bolts of making that conference happen. And if a student does this kind of organizing work, then he or she can get credit as part of the course. And I believe the way to sign up for that is go to the website for Continuing Ed, which I believe is continuingstudies.uml.edu. Continuing Studies, one word. People are most welcome to contact me, and maybe I should just say I'm john_macdougall@uml.edu. The phone number is 978-934-4303. And I'd be delighted to talk to people about the course or any other things that I'm involved in.
Yeah, so it mentions here, examples will be drawn from a wide variety of movements concerned with civil rights, peace and the environment, labor, sexism, gay rights, neighborhood revitalization, plus new right movements. Students can do hands-on projects for credit. Now, what's a new rights movement?
Well, what I mean by that is something that's obviously been very, very prominent for the past 30 years or so. The movement, for example, opposed to abortion.
New
conservative movement. That's what I mean. The anti-abortion movement, a lot of homophobic sentiment, and of course some organizing of opposition to gay rights. Obviously, we've seen this very recently with gay marriage. And also economically, it's been interesting, a whole lot of discussion. A lot of it, of course, led by people in the elite rather than by ordinary folks' discussion about how we need to privatize all kinds of enterprises. I was lucky enough to listen to Jim Hightower just before I came on, and of course he was talking about the privatization of the reconstruction of Iraq, Halliburton et al. And all of this is attributable to a movement which probably many of our listeners are not too keen on, and I personally am not, but I think we really have to understand that new right thinking in economics and in social issues is something that has a grassroots element to it. And sometimes what the new right has done has been violent, like bombing of clinics where abortions get done. But also, on many occasions, these people have protested peacefully, even used traditional, say, Gandhian-type nonviolent civil disobedience. Not frequently, but it's not unknown. So I think it's very important if we're going to understand how social movements are shaping America and our world today, that we also pay attention to this kind of neoconservative movement that is out there and has had a lot of influence.
Oh, I see. So that's what that part meant. I hadn't read it carefully. I apologize.
No problem. That's fine.
This is, it sounds interesting, but at this very moment, of course, I mentioned earlier the people in Georgia are carrying out civil disobedience in one point. They have a 5-point program. I can't remember all of the points, but one of the points is community service, so that in Brunswick, in poor neighborhoods of Brunswick, they're fixing up a house that's going to be a community center for young people. They've had some resistance from the police from this because the police and the military are resisting practically everything that they're doing at this point. But I think it's important that every time that we get together to protest and object to some major thing that's going on in the world that's doing a lot of harm, that we do something constructive, you know, show the way to something constructive. And that's been done pretty well by some of the people from the anti-globalization movement in meetings in Italy and here in Georgia.
Right, that's my understanding too. I'm not that familiar with the movement. We will study that among the other movements in the course, but you're exactly right. And I think it's really important for people who are active for social justice, for peace, to avoid, if they possibly can, getting burnt out and getting discouraged. And it seems to be one way to do that is to work very consciously on areas where they can make a difference. And that often is very much, like you say, Jim, at the local level. And there they can see some fruits to what they do. I have to say, it's interesting that you pointed that news item. Even people who are working on things that look pretty non-controversial, like, say, a food bank or something, you know, for people who are very needy, they may run into problems and conflicts may arise. Because, obviously, we live in a time when many people in both the Bush administration in Washington and in local police forces, they seem to take a pretty punitive and kind of paranoid view of protesters. And so that makes it harder. So it seems to me that I would think if people are going to be prepared to do that, unfortunately, they have to be also prepared for conflicts that will come up and to train for them, if necessary, to use nonviolent civil disobedience, certainly have ways of communicating as civilly as they possibly can with the authorities.
Yeah, so this is, it's important to the people, that more people know this kind of thing. Now, in order to be involved in this summer, the July 13th or August 19th, it is.
Of the course,
in the
right.
Summer course, how soon do people have to sign up?
I would like it as soon as possible. Apparently, they can sign up on the very last night, you know, just when we begin. I prefer that not to do that, because that way we may not have enough textbooks to go around and problems like that could arise. I would say, as a practical matter, it would be really helpful if people could sign up by July the 4th. I should mention one other thing, Jim, which I think I may not have mentioned enough. This is actually a course at the graduate level. Now, people don't have to be enrolled in any graduate program. They can just be people who are interested in checking out, you know, these kind of issues and learning about them, but doing it at the graduate level. If a person has, say, a bachelor's degree in electrical engineering or accounting, I don't care what their undergraduate major might have been, I would really welcome in the class. It's more, you know, having interest in the field. But beyond that, this course does count, of course, towards our new certificate in peace and conflict. It also counts towards the master's degree in regional economic and social development. It counts towards graduate degrees in the work environment department we have here at UMass Lowell. And finally, it counts towards the master's degree in community social psychology. So it does get students some credit towards various programs that we have ongoing.
So I was looking at the other piece of paper here that's attached to this. I'm not sure it's true. In order to get in, you don't need to have taken the graduate record exam or applied to graduate school. Is that correct?
That's correct. To get into my course this fall, all you need to do is visit the website or contact Continuing Ed. And I'm sorry, I don't have the phone number right here. If you want to register by phone, but try calling generally University of Mass Lowell, as you probably know, is 978-934-4000, then ask for Continuing Ed, and they'll put you through by phone if you want to register that way.
Yes. And so it's open to anyone who has a bachelor's degree in any field.
Correct.
And it's open, they're, you know, encouraging the community to get involved in this.
Absolutely. I would be delighted to have people from any walk of life with any kind of interest, as you
may
can see
already be active in some
right
some
Absolutely. If they're already active, fine. If they'd like to get active, that would be fine. I should mention we're going to use one textbook, which I like a lot, called Organizing for Social Change. The senior author is Kim Bobo, B-O-B-O. And what she does in that book with her co-authors is to lay out a whole series of very practical steps about, for example, identifying who your adversaries are, who your allies are, who the neutrals are who might come around to your side, how to define whether you've won or lost, how to come up with very concrete, doable strategies. So I think it's a nice how-to-do-it book. We read some somewhat more abstract kind of theoretical material as well, but that's a book that my students have liked a lot. I'm looking forward to using that again.
Yeah, and there's going to be some hands-on work where you get to practice some of this at the, sometime during the short period of time that the course is going.
Right.
It is a rather short period of time.
Indeed.
So the amount of classroom work, classroom work can't be the major focus, I guess.
Right. There will be some homework. There's no getting around that.
I was wondering about the cost and the financial end of things.
As I understand it, the cost is $1,230 tuition for the one course. And I hope I've got that number right. I'm somewhat a little challenged with math. Mm-hmm. That's my understanding of what the cost is.
That's how it's structured. And do people buy their own textbooks, or do they?
Yes, and usually you can get secondhand textbooks through the bookstore here at UMass Lowell. Although I have to say, one textbook I'm using is brand new, so there won't be used copies of that. And also, I try to make textbooks available at the library too.
Yes, they're usually used ones at the the college bookstore, and I happen to know they're also available on the internet.
Sure. Right. A lot of my students are much more computer savvy than me, which is not saying much. And they have told me, I got such a book for, half of the price at the UMass Lowell bookstore. It's not unknown. Right.
Yeah. So it is they're an expense so that this isn't for people who are struggling to get by or anything.
I hate to say that. That is true. Now, it'd be wonderful. I don't know if it's the case. If perhaps some people in some organizations, maybe their employer might be interested. Certainly there are employers, particularly, of course, in the private sector, who really encourage their workers to get graduate education.
Yeah. And so there may be an employer or subsidy for this kind of education, and there may be other things you can look into getting help from your group that, who need organizer training of some sort.
That's a point, right. Yeah. One thing that I'm hopeful of is if there's already an organization that's doing some interesting work, but may have particularly a longer-term kind of strategic kind of project that it just hasn't had the time to do, they may say, gee, this is a great thing that we'd like to do, and maybe somebody could do it. I've been talking, for example, to some peace activists right here in Lowell. There may be a group, as you may know, called Greater Lowell for Peace and Justice, and they are really interested in working on the Patriot Act, which, of course, has caused no end of problems. And one of their leaders was telling me that they would really love for somebody to research the Act, research how various communities have opposed the Act and what kind of specific approach might be used in bringing community pressure and then ultimately coming out with perhaps a statement by the City of Lowell, like we've had in, I believe now, over 300 communities across the country, a statement that the city does not want to cooperate with the Patriot Act. So that kind of strategic planning might be a good example of a project for somebody to do with me.
So this is very interesting. I guess we'll be talking with you later during the Environmental Corner Hour, focusing more on the environmental effects of violence and things along those lines, but also talking about this course and the things that are happening this summer. So I guess we'll be hearing from you later. Thank you, John McDougall. You want to give your phone number and your email address more time for
it's
people?
John, J-O-H-N, _ McDougall, MacDougall, @uml.edu, and the phone number 978-934-4303.
Thank you again.
Thank you so much for having me on your show.